email that I sent out, we're just going to do as much as we can of Dona Gracia to be able to at least do something of justice for her. And what we're going to talk about here is somebody who was a politically active leader in the Jewish world. And we're going to talk about Dona Gracia herself, as well as the issue of conversos re-entering the Jewish community, because that was what happened for her family, and that was a great concern for her. Claudette, Ricky asked in the chat for the name of the book that you showed. I think it's Dona Gracia. You're muted. I believe the book is called Dona Gracia. Okay. So I brought you on your sheet in source number 10, a translation of part of a letter written by Maimonides. In the time of Maimonides, there were Jews who were facing pressure from the Almohads to convert to Islam. And at one point, he wrote a long letter called Igeret Nechama, a letter of consolation to these conversos to Islam. He wrote, "Our brethren, the Jews who are placed into trouble, may God soon have mercy upon you. The troubles which come from God upon his creations are for a good purpose. God will not trade in the Jewish nation, which he chose among all of the first nations, for another nation. The essence is that one should not cease praying, even if, due to the anger of the oppressor and due to the compulsion, one cannot pray the established prayer at its proper time, evening, morning, and noon. One should still pray an abbreviated prayer. At least they should recite daily that they are members of the Jewish nation, holding their Torah in their hearts." So wrote Maimonides to Jews who have been forced to convert to Islam. And what we're going to see is that that reflects one school within two opposite schools about conversos, and that's going to be very important in the life of Dona Gracia. Let's talk about Dona Gracia herself. Okay, that's where we're going to start this. So, keep in mind as background, 1492, we talked about the expulsion of the Jews from Spain. 1496, 1497, there is a forced conversion of Portuguese Jews. There was supposed to be an expulsion. It ended up being a forced conversion. That's a whole story in its own right. That's before her time. In the year 1510, Dona Gracia is born into a Jewish family that is publicly Christian. The family had originally come from Aragon in Spain. They had fled Spain in 1492 and had gone to Portugal. And then they converted in 1496, 1497. I gave you a list on the sheet after source number 10 of who the players are in this story, because this gets a little bit confusing. Not confusing like the kings of Christian Europe. Not like that confusing, but just there are a lot of people involved in this story. You will notice, as you look at the list of who they are, that each of the people involved, or almost all the people involved, have two names. They have the name that they have within the Jewish world, and then their name that they pass with within the Christian community where they're identified as Christians. So Dona Gracia's father, Jewishly, is Shmuel Nasi. However, his name in Portugal is Agostinho Micas. I hope I'm pronouncing that something like correctly. I don't know. Those who are more cultured here can... Okay, I'm good? Okay. Her father taught medicine in the University of Lisbon. She herself is named Beatrice de Luna Micas, or Gracia Nasi, depending again on where she's being named. Gracia is parallel to what Hebrew name? Chana, exactly. Chana, chain, right? Chain is grace. Gracia is Chana. So you should really call the class Dona Chana, I suppose, as opposed to Dona Gracia. It's unclear how much Jewish education she had in the early going. In general, historians disagree as to how much resistance to Christianity there was among the conversos. Like, were they setting up, you know, secret schools? What were they doing? And it probably varied. However, what is very clear in the course of her life is that she had a significant commitment to Judaism and Jewish education. That was very important to her. In the year 1528, at the ripe old age of 18, she marries a man whose name is Tzemach Benvenisti in the Jewish world, or Francisco Mendes in the world of Portugal. The Benvenisti family was a prominent family, very well known. They were originally from Castilla and Aragon, and they have a public Catholic wedding. However, it's written that they also had a secret Jewish ceremony with a ketubah. They lived in Lisbon, which the Christians, you know, held. And this fellow Tzemach and his brother Diogo, who is Jewishly mayor, ran a powerful spice trading company, particularly black pepper. They also ran a bank, which crossed Europe and was all around the Mediterranean. Very powerful family, because Portugal needs the spice trade for its economy, right? That's what a lot of the exploring was all about. So, a word about names, though. You notice that I keep calling her Dona Gracia, and she's also known at times as Dona Gracia Mendes, right? That's what people often call her as. She never took the name Mendes. Like many women of means back in those days, she did not take her husband's name. So it's effectively an anachronism. When people call her Dona Gracia Mendes, she didn't call herself that. It's also unclear to me when she came to be known with the honorific Doña. I don't know if that was a result of her husband's status and prestige within the community, or if that's something that came from her family or something that came to her. I haven't been able to find out. She and her husband, though, are very active in support of Jews, even as they're publicly Christian. So when Jews had to flee from one place to another, their bank issued letters of credit enabling Jews to bring their assets from the place they were fleeing to their new home. Remember, we talked about, when we talked about Abarbanel, how so many Jews who fled in 1492 had bank drafts that were useless. So in this case, they were enabling Jews to maintain their funds. They bribed the Pope to delay the Inquisition in Portugal, and it worked until 1537, even as they were themselves living publicly as Christians. They dealt with the royalty of France, England, Spain, the Low Countries, as well as they dealt with the popes, they dealt with the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire. They were everywhere. In the year 1537, Dona Gracia has a baby daughter, Ana Reina, who I listed on here. In the year 1538, her husband Francisco passes away. She becomes the manager of the Mendes Empire. It is not clear to me how common this would have been, that her husband passes away and she takes charge of the empire. Much of Europe at this time was governed by Salic law, in which succession is male. However, that may not have been the practice in Spain and Portugal, and it's not clear whether it would have applied to a business as opposed to land. So I don't know whether what she did was just entirely unique or not, but she takes charge of the empire. At the same time, Portugal is becoming impossible for Jews, despite living as Christians. Her husband had been too powerful for the Inquisition, but they were not as intimidated by her as a woman. She leaves. She goes to Antwerp. Her brother-in-law, Diogo, has another branch of the Mendes business that's running in Antwerp. Antwerp at this time, it's mid-16th century, is you can see it there, I gave you the biography, so I gave you some of the years here, is the wealthiest city in Europe. It's a hub of sugar refining and trade, banking. The explorers all go through Antwerp. It's under Spanish control formally, but there is no Inquisition there. There's persecution, a little more, a little less, but no formal Inquisition. The Jews had been expelled in earlier times, but they started coming back again when they left Spain and Portugal. So Dona Gracia, works from her position in Antwerp to enable Jews to flee Christian lands for Ottoman-controlled areas. She's trying to help Jews get out of Christian lands to go to the Ottoman Empire in the south. She transports them, get this, from Portugal to Antwerp using the family's spice ships. She gets them on the boats. From there, they go by cart and foot over the Alps to Venice. If you have the map that I gave you in source number two, this may be helpful. But they go over the Alps to Venice. From Venice, they take ships to Ottoman Greece and Turkey. The Ottomans love Jews. They're very happy to gain the Jews. There's that line that's attributed to the Sultan in 1492 about how Spain doesn't know what it's lost. He makes fun of of Ferdinand and Isabella. Well, she's doing well in Antwerp. In the year 1542, Diego, dies, leaving control of the entire empire to Dona Gracia. The church at the time has been building a case against Diego as a secret Jew. After his death, they open posthumous proceedings, because the church doesn't care about whether he's still alive. What they want is the Mendes Empire. So they agree to drop the case in the event that Dona Gracia will extend a large interest-free loan to the emperor for a period of 2 years. At the same time that she's fending this off, she also has to deal with Christian marriage offers for her daughter, Anna, because everybody wants to marry Anna, because then control of the fortune is going to go to Anna's husband. The Queen Regent of the Netherlands is involved in attempts to marry off Anna to an older Christian man. Finally, she says, I've had enough, Dona Gracia. She flees Antwerp, and she goes to Venice. She's now in Italy. First, she goes with Diogo's widow. Diogo's widow is Dona Gracia's own sister, Brianda. This gets a little complicated. So it's her sister as well as her husband's brother's widow. She also is with Joseph Mikas, who is her nephew. So she's with her brother-in-law's widow, who is also her sister, and she is with her nephew, Joseph. However, this doesn't go well. There's a fight between them about the estate. They end up in court. One source, I said, claimed that her sister denounced her as a secret Jew. Well, the court wants to hold 50% of the estate in escrow for the daughter of Brianda, this sister. Gracia leaves to go to Ferrara, where the Duke of Ferrara promises that he is going to protect her. She goes to Ferrara. She becomes public as a Jew there, reverts to the name Nasi, and becomes a public supporter of Jewish causes. 1552, she goes back to Venice, resolves the estate dispute with her sister, starts to make a major impact and lasting impact on the Jewish world. In the year 1553, she supports the publication of what becomes known as the Ferrara Bible. The Ferrara Bible was published in Ladino. Anybody know what Ladino is? Yes.
Yeah.
Ladino is also... Exactly. Ladino is known as Judeo-Spanish also.
Judeo-Spanish.
Yes. I gave you a link for it in source number 11 to a good article from The Guardian about it at the time when, that article is from when the Royal Spanish Academy officially accepted Ladino as a form of Spanish. Ladino was very popular in the period of the expulsion and thereafter, and yes, you could say it's the Sephardic version of Yiddish, or you could say that Yiddish is the Ashkenazi version of Ladino. Depends on how you look at it. Both are developing at roughly the same time, I believe. So this goal, the goal of this Ferrara Bible that is published then, is to educate conversos. One edition of it was published dedicated to the Duke of Ferrara, and then the other one was dedicated to Dona Gracia. for all of her efforts on behalf of the Jewish world, the Jewish community. Later in the same year, a writer published a prose poem in Portuguese reviewing all of Jewish history called Consolations for the Tribulations of Israel. And this was also dedicated to Dona Gracia. She stays there until 1553, when she goes at the invitation of the Sultan to Constantinople. Constantinople / Istanbul, we know. Fine. In the Ottoman Empire, she has no need to masquerade at all in any form as Christian. She expands her business very successfully. Wool, pepper, grain, imports of cloth and textiles. She has her own ships. She negotiates with governments personally. And her daughter, who is now 16, she arranges to marry her nephew, Don Joseph. I guess the estate thing is now truly in the past. So that's not so unusual, the marriage of first cousins. That could happen. Her support for Jewish causes is now really unleashed. She tries to strengthen Judaism everywhere. There was a group of conversos in 1556 who wanted to live in the Spanish port of Ancona, and the Pope told them they could live there. However, when they arrived, there was a new Pope, Paul IV. He did not honor the guarantees of safety for them, and in fact, finds them to be secret Jews, and orders that they be burned at the stake. Dona Gracia organizes a trade embargo of the Ancona port in response. There's debate about how effective it was, did it actually work, but I just find it cool that she did that. That she's ordering an embargo of the port in response to the Pope. She supported yeshivot, Torah academies, in Constantinople and elsewhere. She becomes known by the title of La Senora, or Parnassessa. A Parnas is an old term referring to someone who is a leader and supporter of the Jewish community. Parnassessa, presumably, is a female version of Parnas. We find that in epitaphs in ancient Italian communities, interestingly. So she is known by these titles, and there is a shul that is named for her called La Senora. If you go to source number 12, I gave you a link there. It still stands in Izmir in Turkey on the street of the synagogues. So they named the shul La Senora for her.
She Parnas come from the word Parnasa?
Yes.
She was like providing
the supporter of the community, yes. That's correct. She was also extremely Zionist. She asked Sultan Suleiman to lease Jerusalem to her. He refused. So, in the year 1558, she gets him to lease Tiberia, to her in exchange for an increase in tax revenues. The Ottomans had conquered it years before, but had not really developed it. So she begins to rebuild the towns in the area of the Kinneret, in the area of Tiberias, to make it available for Jews who had been living as Christians, who had been living as Jews in hiding. So the conversos should be able to go to Tiberias and restart their lives there. She wanted to go there herself. The historian Cecil Roth, whose work on this is invaluable, records that her husband was actually buried there, and she wanted to go there as well. In the year 1565, a Portuguese visitor to Israel describes the Jewish inhabitants of the Holy Land being all excited, thinking that La Senora was going to show up. However, it appears she never made it. It appears that she died in Constantinople in the year 1569, but she wanted to be buried in Tiberias, and she actually ends up being buried on Har HaZeitim, Mount of Olives, in Jerusalem. Interestingly, New York City designated a Dona Gracia Day in June of 2010. Philadelphia did it in 2011 in honor of her 500th birthday. The Turkish government sponsored a Dona Gracia evening at that time in New York City and an exhibit in Lisbon. The Israeli Mint produced a commemorative medal, And there's a museum about her in Tiberias. So, last point here. A very important issue for her was, as we've seen, the fate of conversos. She tried to smuggle them to safety. She tried to forestall the Inquisition against them. She tried to educate them. The whole Ladino Bible is about them. She provides, you know, life in Tiberias for them. This was an old issue in Judaism. Going back to my Moroccan Jewry and the Almohad forced conversions, and some of you were in a class that I did about this a while back. Oh, you know when? It was at Beth Tikva. It was at Beth Tikva pre-COVID. We did a series on anti-Semites, and I mentioned at the time, we talked about the Umayyads and the Almohads. That was when we did it. So when the Almohads force the Jews, by the way, someone sent me a message in the chat, very interestingly, that in the Jewish community in Gibraltar, the cemetery stones have Ladino writing on them. I did not know that. Thank you. So when the Almohads forced the Jews to convert, there was a leading Jewish scholar whose name is not known to us, who wrote an open letter to the community saying that if you accept the Muslim terms, you shouldn't bother praying to God, you shouldn't bother trying to do any mitzvot, it's all worthless. Maimonides was furious, and he wrote a 4-part letter completely toasting this fellow. Like, completely, his first part of the 4 is just about what a fool this fellow is. He completely takes him to pieces. And he says it's simply wrong. First of all, in terms of what the Muslims were demanding, they were demanding a public declaration that the Quran is true and that Muhammad was the last prophet of God. Which, you know, contradicts Judaism, but is not quite the same as idolatry. But Maimonides writes a long letter about how this fellow was wrong. And I brought you a piece of it in source number 13 from part 3, in which he says, I will now explain the error in which this one who increased emptiness fell. This guy who wrote to you made a mistake. Ahav ben Omri, he says, King Ahab, who was not a righteous king, who denied God and worshipped idols, and about whom God testified there was never another like Ahav, in a bad way. The biblical text described him as being awful. Nonetheless, we're taught he fasted for 2.5 hours, and then the sages taught the decree upon him was voided. God did not cheat him of the reward. In other words, he did something good. God rewarded him for the good that he did. So, even if you had to do something terrible, that doesn't remove the good things that you've done. If God would give good reward for small good deeds for these well-known heretics, then how could God not reward Jews who were forced into shmad, into assimilation, and who perform mitzvot in private? Would there be no distinction for God between those who perform mitzvot and those who did not, those who served God and those who did not? He said, of course, those who did something good will be rewarded for it. So he said, keep on practicing whatever Judaism you can and get out of Morocco as fast as you can. That's on one side. On the other side, in the German school, you have the Pietists at the same time as Maimonides. Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, in source number 14, speaks glowingly about those who are killed to honor God's name. And he says, you know, there are some people who are not killed. They die at God's hand upon their beds. However, those people, if they had been in the situation of forced conversion, would have been killed. They shouldn't lose out for the fact that they didn't get killed. And he says, their reward, in 14, their reward is only reduced by the benefit they received in fulfillment of their desire not to enter such a situation, but to live and bear children. Those who are killed receive greater reward for the benefit they did not receive in this world. So he says, yeah, better to be killed, but if you didn't merit to be killed, you'll lose something because you got, you know, to live, and we know you really wanted that, but, you know, it would be better to be killed. So you have two different philosophies going here. Not that Maimonides disagrees about the holiness of those who died in God's name, but the school of Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid and others at the same time in the world of Ashkenaz really trumpeted the praise of martyrs. There was a lot of discussion at the time of how to welcome people back if they've converted out to Christianity and then they want to come back to Judaism. And it was very controversial. Because if you're going to welcome people back, maybe that's going to encourage others to just pretend to be Christian and take, so to speak, the easy route. We have models in Tanakh for Jews who get killed rather than bow to a statue, right? The story of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah in the book of Daniel in chapter 3 is a prime example. This caused a lot of fighting. In early Ashkenaz, in Germany in the 10th century, Rabbeinu Gershom was the leader at the time. He was the Rebbe of the Rebbe's, Rebbeim of Rashi. So Rabbeinu Gershom issued a public decree that you are not allowed to remind conversos of their past. Meaning, if they lived as Christians and then came back to live as Jews, you are not allowed to remind them of the fact that they lived as Christians for a period of time. And we have a responsum of Rashi in source number 15 dealing with a case in his day, two generations later, in which there was a fight between two families and one of them specifically said, you assimilated, your family assimilated to Christianity during that period. And the other one says, no, you're not allowed to mention that. Rabbeinu Gershom decreed. This was a live issue for them. Can you accept them as witnesses in court? All sorts of issues. This is what was so important to Dona Gracia, was to try to welcome these people back and reintegrate them into the Jewish world. At the end of the sheet, I gave you three references to books I used in preparing this. Dona Gracia and the House of Nasi. Cecil Roth. Claudette, was that what you were holding up? Yeah. That's amazing as a book. The Long Journey of Gracia Mendes and The Woman Who Defied Kings, The Life and Times of Dona Gracia Nasi. In addition, I noted two books of historical fiction, which I have not read. One by Naomi Regan, one by Emily Barnett. I can't speak to the quality of either of those, but there's a lot more to be said. We got something in about her.
I found this very easy reading, and it was very interesting.
From Cecil Roth.
Yeah,
I'm going to hang on 1 second. I'm just going to put spotlight on you for a minute so that people can see it better. Hold it up. Okay, so people can now see the book better. Okay. So I'll take the spotlight off. You don't have to deal with that. Go back to gallery view for those who want to see gallery. That's in a nutshell something at least about Dona Gracia. Thank you so much for participating in the course. I sent out an email last night about Sunday, a free program, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., 12 to